So Psalm 68 talks about the word, the people of Cush, which is another name for Ethiopia, reaching out to God. 1 Kings chapter 10, the Queen of Sheba comes to Jerusalem to see Solomon. The people of Ethiopia down through the ages have long believed that Sheba is another name for Ethiopia. It is certainly the name for some kingdom in the southern part of the Red Sea, almost certainly on the African side of the Red Sea, and probably either a reference to Ethiopia or maybe Nubia. And in Acts chapter 8, we have the Ethiopian eunuch. So when we think about the history of the church, it's easy to focus on the church in the West. This is a story that many people know and are reasonably familiar with, to think about the church with Rome as sort of the center. But there's a bunch of reasons why that's not entirely true. And so today I want to spend some time looking east and south. So next slide, I want to start by talking about the church in Ethiopia. The church in Ethiopia is an ancient church, and an African church, and it sees itself as connected to the story of the Queen of Sheba and connected to the story of the Ethiopian eunuch, successors, that the current church is a successor to the people who were influenced by those stories and who are heirs to that tradition. So the image here at the lower left is the interior of a famous church, Debir Birhan Selassie Church, which means Trinity and Mountain of Light, which is the most famous place of worship in a place called Gondar in Ethiopia. It's surrounded by, the approach is between 12 round towers, stone towers, which represent the 12 apostles. And then at the head of the line of these 12 round towers leading up to the church, there's a 13th tall tower, which is taller than the rest of them, and it represents the Lion of Judah. And there is a lion imprinted at the top of that tower. The interior of the church is very vividly painted and decorated with stories, representations of stories from the Bible. It's a church that was built with the intent that people who did not know the language and could not read could still understand the stories. And this is one of the drivers of art down through the ages in the church, is that the art should tell the story, and particularly to people who cannot read the words. And so the church of Debir Birhan Selassie at Gondar is a great example of that. The actual current church was rebuilt in the 1880s on a model of something from much earlier after it had been destroyed. But it's a representation of the art and the activity of the people worshiping in Ethiopia. And you can see there's two arched doors in the back, and between them there is a crucified Christ who looks very much the way that we often depict Jesus today in our culture. And so the church here at lower right is a church that is actually hewn directly out of the rock. It wasn't built, it was carved. It's the Church of St. George in a place called Lalibela, which is formerly the capital of Ethiopia. The Emperor Lalibela Gebre Meskel built this church and about a dozen others during his reign between about 1181 and about 1221. And so the lower right is a picture of the exterior of that church. And the top left is a picture of what the roof of that church looks like. They carved a cross in a very distinctive way into the roof of that church. This church, potentially, the Patriarch of Alexandria, the Pope at Alexandria, as he was and is known, sent an embassy to visit the Emperor Lalibela in Ethiopia in AD 1210. And they probably came and visited this church. And the top right is another church, also hewn from the rock in the area of Lalibela, one of the things that the emperor had carved or had built during his reign. So, at the beginning of the 13th century, Christianity is a powerful force in Ethiopia, but Christianity goes back much, much further than that in Ethiopia. And when you think about the churches in Egypt and Ethiopia, the difference between the two in terms of where they start is the church in Egypt, the church around Alexandria, has very deep cultural Roman and Greek influences from the very beginning. Those who founded that church and who built that church up in the first century and beyond were really influenced by Roman and Greek culture. And so there was a mark on that church of those cultures. The people that founded the church in Ethiopia came from Jerusalem. They came out of the Hebrew culture. They had relatively little Roman and Greek cultural influences. So the church in Ethiopia has a lot more connection to Israel directly than, say, the church in Egypt and the church other places, and is kind of distinctively Ethiopian from the very early days. It's worth keeping in mind that Ethiopia is about 1,500 miles south of Alexandria. And so over land, that's a gigantic journey. And so the way that people came from Alexandria to Ethiopia was to go over to the Red Sea, to sail down the Red Sea coast, and then to go inland up into the highlands of Ethiopia. But from the 3rd or 4th century up through the 7th century, the kingdom of northern, what is now northern Ethiopia, which was called Aksum at the time, was very prosperous, a very highly developed society, and dominated trade across and along the Red Sea in those centuries. But the Ethiopian church believes that the Queen of Sheba's story is not only true, but that the Queen of Sheba was really from Ethiopia, and that there's a bunch of stuff that doesn't show up in 1 Kings that is really important to the story, that there's other drama. Among other things, they believe that the Queen of Sheba, having gone up and visited Solomon and heard all these things and spent time with him, came home pregnant by Solomon, and that in her 1,800 or so mile journey home took so long that she gave birth to a son along the way and returned to Ethiopia with a son who became the prince and heir to the throne. And that Solomon had given her, among other things, a signet ring, a very private, personal identifying item, and that her son that she had by Solomon, when 2 decades later, as a young man, he puts the signet ring on and makes the trek back to Jerusalem, where Solomon, in his old age, is still king. And Solomon recognizes him by the ring and greets him as his son and sends him back to Ethiopia with great gifts and a delegation of priests from the temple. And on the way back, the young prince discovers that the priests of the temple have brought with them the Ark of the Covenant from the temple. And that this is what happened. to the Ark of the Covenant, that it was smuggled out of Jerusalem in the time of Solomon and taken to Ethiopia. And there is still a church in Ethiopia that claims to have held the Ark of the Covenant for more than 1,500 years. So, for what that's worth, these are traditions that influence the church in Ethiopia today. And these are stories that the Ethiopian church today looks back to. And as a result, the Ethiopian church is different than almost any other Christian church around the world, because the Ethiopian church feels a connection to ancient Israel and practices some things which are derived from that connection, in which they believe they're doing in honor of Solomon, who is father of one of the kings of Ethiopia, they believe. And so in Ethiopia, in the Ethiopian church, boys are circumcised on the eighth day after they're born, as they were in ancient Israel, as Jesus was, as John the Baptist was. And in the Ethiopian church, even today, down through the ages, they have practiced various Old Testament rules for personal cleanliness and washing, and many of the dietary laws that are in the Old Testament are integrated into the Christian church and the Christian worship in Ethiopia. And Ethiopia has the challenge because of the distances. Ethiopia was relatively isolated from Alexandria and very much so from Rome, and was in many ways a culturally isolated, independent church for many hundreds of years. Eventually, Ethiopia came under the authority of the Pope at Alexandria. And it was not until 1959 that the Ethiopian church began to appoint its own leaders. Until 1959, going back more than 1,000 years, the head of the Ethiopian church, the Archbishop of Ethiopia, had been appointed by the Pope at Alexandria. And for much of that time, the Pope at Alexandria appointed an Egyptian to be the head of the Ethiopian church. So it's only been since 1959 that the Ethiopian church has appointed its own leader, and that person has consistently been Ethiopian. So the Ethiopian church calls itself the Orthodox Tewahedo. Tewahedo means being made one or unified, and it's not about the unified church. They don't mean that the people in the church are unified. They mean that Jesus has one single unified nature. The big division point between the Ethiopian church and much of the church in the East and the church in the West that we think of today is the nature of Jesus Christ. So the Ethiopian church, the Tewahedo, being made one unified thing, is a belief that Jesus has a single unified nature, that his divine and human natures are completely and naturally unified into one person, one nature. In the West, it is believed that Jesus has two natures, and then the natures, his humanity and his divinity, are not mixed. They're unseparated, but they are separated, but unified in the sense of what we call the hypostatic union is the thing that that people have been saying for hundreds and hundreds of years. But the idea that his divine nature and human nature are not intermingled, they are both present all the time. And so this is a theological point that has some significance, but this is really the theological difference here between many of the churches of the East and the church in Ethiopia and the churches in the West. And this is a dispute that comes from the Council of Chalcedon in AD 451. which remains unresolved. But Ethiopia, rejecting Chalcedon in AD 451, at the time was aligning with the patriarchs of Alexandria and Antioch in Jerusalem against the patriarchs of Rome and Constantinople. In any case, the Ethiopian church believes that the eunuch in Acts chapter 8 that Philip the evangelist baptized was a guy who served a woman whose name really wasn't Candace, but whose name was the Queen Gersamot Hendeki the VII, who was queen of Ethiopia between about 42 and 52 AD. So that's the right time. So there's also other people that believe that Candace wasn't queen of Ethiopia at all, that the Acts chapter 8 reference is actually to Candace, who is queen of Nubia, and that the eunuch went back and did not convert the queen, and Nubia wasn't evangelized until the 6th century. So there's various beliefs here. But there are people in Ethiopia today that believe that the eunuch came back, evangelized the queen, and that is the beginning of the church in Ethiopia under Queen Gersamot Hendeki the VII, who is queen from 42 to 52. Northern Ethiopia, Aksum, the kingdom of Aksum, was subsequently evangelized, maybe again, by a guy named Frumentius, who was kind of shipwrecked on the Red Sea coast while headed to India, as a teenager, and who became a servant to the king, sort of a story a little bit like Daniel, and eventually became a very important leader in the king's ruling group there in the northern part of Ethiopia in Aksum. And Frumentius eventually was sent home with great thanks and went to Alexandria and reported in that he had been in the court of the Ethiopian king and that there was a great opportunity for evangelism, that the king had been converted, but that there was no real leadership for the church at that time. Pope of Alexandria, the Bishop of Alexandria, got a group of bishops together. They discussed this, prayed about it, and they decided to make Frumentius the Bishop of Ethiopia and send him back. That Pope of Alexandria, by the way, who headed that process, was a guy named Athanasius, the guy from the Council of Nicaea, the guy who stood for orthodoxy, for the Trinitarian faith for all those years. He is also the guy who appointed Frumentius the first bishop of Ethiopia in AD 328, 3 years after the Council of Nicaea. And so Ethiopia, the Ethiopian church has many potential starting points. When Frumentius went back, the king Izana of Aksum, who ruled from 320 to about 356, was converted to the faith and became the first African monarch to be converted to the faith. This is another significant step in the movement of the faith, in this case to the south. When the Islamic forces, the Arab armies, came rolling out of Arabia, they conquered the entire greater Middle East, Syria, the land of ancient Israel, Judea, Egypt, most of northern Africa, what is now Jordan and Iraq, Mesopotamia. The only place that they failed to conquer in the whole greater Middle East was Ethiopia. And Ethiopia remains the only place in the greater Middle East that has never been conquered by an Islamic army and has remained as a Christian nation where Christianity was the majority faith for at least 18 centuries and maybe longer. But the Ethiopian church has remained fairly vital down through the years. In 1439, the Ethiopian church sent an embassy to the Pope at Rome to speak to the Pope, not to ask him for help, really, but to say, we're the church too, and we would like to interact and have some back and forth and be in fellowship with you. In 1520, Jesuit missionaries came to Ethiopia and were amazed at how many churches there were in Ethiopia. One of the Jesuit missionaries said, in Ethiopia, when people are singing in a church, there's another church that's within hearing distance where people are also singing, and you can hear multiple churches all at the same time. There are so many churches in Ethiopia. In any case, Jesuit missionaries stayed for almost 150 years attempting to convert the Ethiopians to Roman Catholicism, and then, having achieved very little, were eventually expelled. And the Ethiopians stayed with what they call the Ethiopian Orthodox Church. The Ethiopian church, to even today, uses, as it has for hundreds and hundreds of years, uses a canon of scripture that has 81 books. So we have 66 books in our Bible. They have the same 66 books, plus they've got the Hebrew Book of Enoch and most of the books that we consider the Apocrypha that are available, in books that are more Roman, in a more Roman Catholic version of the Bible. The Shepherd of Hermas, 1st and 2nd Clement, the stories of the Maccabees, and there are a series of texts in the Ethiopian Bible that were written in Ethiopia, and they're Ethiopian stories that seem to have been derived from the books of Maccabees or other things, other sources, but which are heroic stories of early men and women in the Ethiopian church, which are part of the Ethiopian church's Bible even today. The challenge today really is that outside of the cities, most of the priests and people, men who have leadership roles in the Ethiopian church, are very poorly educated. Many of them are illiterate or functionally illiterate, and a lot of them are not much better than really witch doctors. The educational piece of the church there has really declined over the last 400 or 500 years. And there are a lot of smaller people groups across Ethiopia that are culturally isolated because they speak different languages. So why do we support missions in Ethiopia? Because of those things. And of course, this is why our target is really the Awi people, who have never actually been evangelized effectively down through the years. So that's why we still support missions in Ethiopia, even though the Ethiopian church is one of the oldest in the world. Some things that are kind of important ideas that come out of the story of the Ethiopian church. First of all, the Ethiopian church, there's a whole lot of stuff down through the ages about kind of communal conversion, the sense that the king or the head of the clan is converted, and so everybody comes with that. But everyone is culturally very loyal to that person, and so they're not just followers, but they are truly committed to whatever it is that the head of the group is doing. Ethiopia is a place, it's one of the first places where you see Bible translation. One of the early places where there's Bible translation, the Ge'ez language, which was the common language of Ethiopia in the 3rd, 4th, 5th century at least, the Bible was translated very early into that, and this is probably the time that the local books that are included in the Ethiopian Bible were probably written, because they were written in the Ge'ez language. Ethiopia is an example of what we see as kind of the Eastern model. We think of the church east and west, east being Constantinople and Alexandria and places east and south of that. The church based at Constantinople, Alexandria, Antioch, Edessa, those centers of the church working east and south. The model that those churches used, whether they were Greek-speaking or Syriac-speaking, was as the gospel went into different areas, when it crossed a linguistic line to translate the Bible and the liturgy and some stories of kind of key saints and leaders of the church into that local language. And so this translated into the local Ge'ez language of Ethiopia became the model for the whole Eastern Church and the evangelization of Eastern Africa, Arabia, and all the way across Asia fell on that model. The Western Church, the church primarily based at Rome as it evangelized west and north across Europe, followed a model where the Bible having been translated into Latin, that the Bible was in Latin, the liturgy was in Latin, the stories of the great heroes of the church were in Latin, and the people that were evangelized were taught enough Latin so that they could participate in the worship. And those who wanted to become priests, leaders in the church, had to learn Latin. And so in the Western church, everything stayed in Latin and people had to come to the language that things were in. But in the Eastern Church, it became the standard to translate the word into the language of the local people. And so Ethiopia follows that Eastern model and is one of the very first examples of that. And Ethiopia really has this very distinctive Christian culture. The Ethiopian church believes that it is basically the new Israel. And that the king of Ethiopia, or the emperor, down through Haile Selassie, who was deposed by the Italians here in the 20th century, were descended from Solomon. And that the Ark of the Covenant was long in possession of the church in Ethiopia. And so, so Ethiopia, very early church and expansion of the church, the gospel across cultural lines and linguistic lines in a model that becomes very much the standard in the Eastern Church. Nick? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you know, the Rastafarianism, of course, which is more of a Caribbean kind of a thing, is a much later kind of syncretistic sort of merging of multiple things. And as you see the gospel going forth, you know, even in the 5th, 6th, 7th centuries, you start to see these cultural adaptations. You know, the Ethiopian church looks different than the church does around Rome. It's culturally different. It absorbs some cultural things that are important to local people there. And so, you know, when you look at the bottom left here, there's a lot of African-themed things, very African styles of music being adopted. The colors of the art are very vibrant in a way that is really not the color palette of what we're seeing in things in Rome and parts of the Western church that are also, you know, just as old. And so it's really important to keep in mind that the church adopts and adapts things as it moves into different cultures, connecting to people kind of where they are. And part of what we have is a very American kind of interpretation of what the church should look like, right? You know, we do some things that are very American kind of driven. You know, we spend a fair amount of money, you know, in my time here on, you know, paving the parking lot and repaving the parking lot and putting stripes out there because parking lot matters. in this culture, right? And, you know, it's not the only thing, but we've got a lot of kind of Americanism in what we do and how we do it. And so, but you see a lot of the things, you know, whether it's Rastafarianism or other kinds of things, are these people taking elements of different things and kind of fusing them together into something new and different. And, you know, it's a testament to the strength and power of Christianity that so often people feel like something from the Bible needs to be part of whatever it is that they're doing. It's almost impossible to build a cult group without saying, well, yeah, we value the Bible and this other thing, right? Jesus and kind of stuff. There's Christianity has enough of a cultural footprint that you kind of can't invent something without trying to adapt something that comes from Christianity. Next slide. So another thing that's important to keep in mind, you know, we talked about the fall of the Western Empire, the fall of Rome. The empire, the Roman Empire, endures in the East for centuries, basically for 1,000 years after the fall of Rome. And so people call it the Byzantine Empire. But the people who lived in that empire never called it that, and never thought of themselves as Byzantine. So we use the term Byzantine because Byzantium was the small city that was near the place where Constantine built Constantinople. Byzantium was an ancient city that preceded Constantinople and was eventually kind of incorporated into Constantinople. But the Eastern Roman Empire endures. It waxes and wanes, but it sticks around. So the red line, Justinian I, in the early to mid-500s, is by far the most powerful and successful of the emperors of the Eastern Empire, and he conquers briefly most of what had been the empire under Constantine. He conquers all of Italy and part of southern Spain and most of North Africa and Egypt and, Syria and Judea. All this becomes part of the empire briefly under Justinian for a few decades. And that's very much the high water mark of the Eastern Empire. But the lighter reddish, the pinkish is, you know, in the year 1020, that's about the extent of the Eastern Empire. And that's kind of most of the time of the history of the Byzantine Empire. That's about the size and shape. And then the deeper red there, that's just a spot to the west of Constantinople and a couple of spots in what is now Greece, that's the empire in 1360. But Constantinople, Constantine's design for Constantinople made it almost impossible to besiege and to conquer. And so Constantinople was attacked repeatedly, and no one ever came very close to conquering it until, we're well into the second millennium. And so Attila the Hun came around the Black Sea and down through Bulgaria and thought that he would have a go at Constantinople. And once his scouts came back and reported on the walls and the way the city was defended, he decided to move west and attack Rome instead, because Rome seemed like a much easier target. And it actually was. And Constantinople, the Eastern Roman Empire, spent 7 centuries at war with the forces of Islam. 7 centuries of almost continual warfare to the east and to the south with the forces of Islam, the Islamic armies. And so when you think about the Byzantine world, and of course Byzantine is a modern term that we apply to them, we tend to think of Byzantine as really complicated. We use that word to identify something where the politics are very difficult to understand, and the strategic balancing is very, very difficult to get a hold of. But that reflects the very difficult strategic situation that the Eastern Empire found themselves in. They were pressed from the south and east by Islamic armies for hundreds of years, from the north by tribal groups of Azars and Bulgars and others. They found themselves in conflict with Western kingdoms that probably ought to have been allies. Language was a barrier there because the Eastern Empire continued to speak Greek long after the Western world had moved to Latin. And the Eastern Empire was very dependent on trade. And when you look at how they were basically surrounded by either active or potential enemies, the people to trade with were almost always people that they had very fraught political relationships with. They also had the issue that the emperor and the patriarch being in the same city created some really weird political dynamic. And early on, within 100 years of the time of Constantine, it became the standard for senior members of the government, the sort of prime ministers and key ministers of the government, to be made eunuchs, to prevent them from being able to overthrow the emperor. And so key members of the government were men who had been made eunuchs, and as a result of which they could not have children, and therefore they could not become the emperor. And this created some really weird political maneuvering because the eunuchs worked on one side or worked on another side, but they could never actually be the winners of the conflict. In any case, the Eastern Empire saw itself as the place that the Roman heritage and the Christian heritage were to be preserved in the face of very difficult times. And the people of the Eastern Roman Empire never called themselves Byzantines. They always called themselves, for 1,000 years, they called themselves the Romani. That is, they always thought of themselves as Romans. All the way to the end. They thought that they were the heirs to the Roman Empire, that they were preserving the Greek language, Roman law, Roman customs. The emperor was a successor to Constantine, and that they were ultimately the last Roman army. Constantinople did not fall to Islamic forces until 1453. So there were most emperors, most groups of emperors, there's 3 or 4 or 5 generations in a family. And so the majority of the emperors are the sons of a previous emperor. But then there's somebody else comes in. And in the later days, it becomes very common that a successful general becomes the emperor in Constantinople, even if he's not related to anybody who's previously been the emperor. It becomes a thing later on that if you've had very significant success leading the armies against the Bulgars or in conquered significant territory, that you return in victory and you become sort of the heir to the throne, even if you're not related. And so when you look at the history, the imperial history, there'll be a line of, 4 or 5 emperors from one family, and then there'll be some other family that'll have a couple, and then a different family. But the key government ministers often remain the same, even as the emperors change. So, and the military became a consistent way to become emperor. But this is also an imperial church. The church in Rome is marked by imperial markers from the Western era. The church in Constantinople remains an imperial church all the way up into the 1400s because the emperor lives down the street. And when the empire is doing well, when trade is going well and the economy is good, a lot of money flows into the church. And so great cathedrals, a lot of focus on building, making great art, great music. There's early work on, you know, hymns and great songs. The art, one of the things in particular becomes the making of what are called icons, images of key leaders in the church, which eventually becomes a huge controversy, but remains an artistic model today that comes out of the church at Constantinople through this whole era. But the Eastern Roman Empire endures, and the church at Constantinople remains very influential for centuries as a result. In fact, the church at Constantinople, the church at Antioch, and the church at Alexandria launch missions that are hugely impactful. Next slide. The Eastern Church moves from, Constantinople there at the top left in what is the Eastern Roman Empire, and Alexandria there at the base of the Nile near the head of the Red Sea, and moves out to the east over the next few centuries here. And much of this is in the Syriac language. When you get to the eastern suburbs of Antioch by the 3rd, 4th century, the people there speak Syriac. And as you keep going east, Syriac is the standard language out past the Caspian Sea and into Central Asia. And Syriac is a language that's pretty closely related to Aramaic, which, of course, is the language that Jesus almost certainly preached in, because it was the language of the common people at the time. And so Syriac, being very closely related to Aramaic, the church that spoke Syriac in the east feels very connected to Jesus and the apostles and where they walked and talked in Galilee in particular. And so this is the standard language east along what becomes the Silk Road into Central Asia. And so the Syriac language is a unifying force for the church in the east here. But Edessa, we've talked about, became a significant center of the church and a place that fostered a lot of growth and sent many missionaries. There was a large group of monasteries to the east of the city that were a key place for growing leaders of the church. Ctesiphon in Mesopotamia becomes a critical center of the church and really the head of the Eastern Church for centuries. And much of this, the Parthian Empire is an opponent of Rome through the first and second and into the third centuries. The Parthian Empire is eventually destroyed and overtaken by something called Sassanid Persia, which is founded in 224 and exists until 651 AD. And so Sassanid Persia unites much of the Eastern Church and becomes the major opponent of the Roman Empire in the East. for those 4 or 5 centuries. And Sassanid Persia is for the most part religiously tolerant, although there is several decades of very active persecution of Christians. It did revive Zoroastrianism, kind of the great last great moment of that faith as an official faith. But for the most part, Sassanid Persia was fairly religiously tolerant. And the Sassanid Persian Empire expanded to the west in the early 600s in a great destructive war against the Eastern Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire. The Sassanids conquered Antioch and Jerusalem and Alexandria and marched across Asia Minor and threatened Constantinople. And they were subsequently thrown back. And after more than 2 decades of war between Sassanid Persia and what we think of as the Byzantine Empire, they ended up with almost exactly the same story that they are territory that they started with, except they had spent giant amounts of money and killed massive numbers of people and exhausted themselves militarily and economically in the process. Which 2 decades later meant that when the Islamic armies were unleashed out of Arabia, neither of them was well prepared to respond. So the church in the East is very culturally distinct. There's a lot of Semitic influence, a lot of things that they believe come very much from the Aramaic, from Galilee, from the original church, from the apostles themselves. It's the Greek influence comes only later, but many of their key practice and ideas are derived from Aramaic and Hebrew sources. And there's a guy named Ephrem who is a 4th century poet, died in 373, and his hymns became famous and widely used not only across the whole Eastern Church, from Syria and far to the east, but also in the West. And many of his hymns are sung in Rome and elsewhere. In the East, Ephrem's work was that the standard of his hymnography and the standard of his teaching was so high that many things that he wrote became part of the liturgy of churches in the East for the next hundreds of years. So the church in the East was beset by a number of splits and controversies. Chalcedon, AD 451, the conflict over the different interpretations of the human and divine natures of Christ, whether that was one nature or two, split the church in the East from the church in the West. That is, Rome and Constantinople said two natures held in hypostatic union in the churches at Antioch and Alexandria and points east and Jerusalem as well, all said one nature bound together. And so they began to regard one another as heretics. And so the church in the West basically excommunicated every Christian east of Constantinople over this. Even though the church east of Constantinople was very large and very rapidly growing. The Eastern Church eventually split 3 ways. There are groups called Melkites and Maronites who believed that the Council of Chalcedon was right and that the churches in the East were wrong to reject it. And so there's a strain through the Eastern Church that remained in communion with Constantinople. And today there remains a significant Maronite church in Lebanon. The principal Christian church of Lebanon is Maronite. That is, it's people who hold to the Council of Chalcedon and who have been separated theologically from the other churches in the East by that for years. The Melkite Church still looks to the patriarchs at Antioch and Alexandria. That's not an ethnic group church, but there are churches scattered throughout the East that still look to those patriarchs, but who are aligned with Chalcedon theologically. The church in Egypt, the Coptic Church, chose to follow their own patriarch in Alexandria. They are sometimes called the Jacobites after a bishop of Edessa that eventually united with them, or called Miaphysites because of their view that Christ has one nature, which is both divine and human. They reject Chalcedon. The biggest group in the East for centuries was the Nestorians, after a guy named Nestorius. They remained primarily Syriac-speaking for centuries. The Nestorians are the major church of Sassanid Persia, the major church of Central Asia, and long believed that they are the true church of the East. Their patriarch was at Ctesiphon in Mesopotamia and later at Baghdad. But it is the Nestorian church that expands along the Silk Road across Central Asia and all the way to China. Indeed, by the early 600s, the Nestorian church had missionaries in China, and maybe significantly before that. And by AD 800, the Nestorian church had bishops in several major Chinese cities, including Beijing. So across the Silk Road and north and south of that, the Nestorian Church, the Church of the East, expanded for many, for centuries. There was a school at a city called Nisibis, which is northeast of Edessa, established a very famous Christian school, which became the standard in the East. It was a school that taught language and grammar and rhetoric with scripture as the text, taught scriptural study focused on interpretation and then a commentary, and provided a really disciplined intellectual program that wasn't just school. It was a fully holistic experience that was about forming the lives and morals of the students. There was an ongoing regime of prayer and worship and service outside the classes. And so the school at Nisibis became the standard in the Eastern Church and spawned many churches across the East. And in the late 500s, a guy came from Rome and visited it and thought, this is genius, and went back and founded one in southern Italy, which became the model for Western education in later years. The church in the East was persecuted in the Sassanid Empire. It had gone far beyond that empire already, but in the empire it was persecuted for about two decades, but emerged from that persecution significantly stronger. The Nestorian Church believes in the Council of Nicaea and the Council of Constantinople. The Nicene Creed works for them and has down through the centuries. So in AD 410, the Eastern Church called a council of all of its bishops, which was attended by many of them at Ctesiphon, in which it affirmed the Nicene Creed. In a follow-up council in 424, it decreed that it need not be ruled from Constantinople or Rome or any place else in the West, but that it was also an apostolic church. The church in the East expanded using a very large cluster of monasteries around Edessa and then Ctesiphon, and then Merv is out along the Silk Road there east of the Caspian Sea and became a huge center of Christianity for centuries. Places where the scriptures were copied and distributed, where the education of future leaders went on, and where Christian culture was cultivated. From the 7th century to the 14th century, the church in the East was by far the largest part of the church when you think about it geographically and probably also in population. It's hard to say how much growth the church had in India, but there was a significant presence in southern India already, and that was supported primarily from Alexandria. But the church also grew in Aksum in Ethiopia and all the way to Sri Lanka in this period. And Alexandria and Antioch remained very influential sources for the church in the East for centuries. And the church in the East eventually converts the Mongol Empire, which also is sort of like the conversion of Constantine in that it has some pluses and minuses that are challenges for us to deal with. But let's think about distances. From Jerusalem to Antioch is 800 miles, but from Jerusalem to Baghdad is 600 miles. From Jerusalem to Rome is 1,400 miles, but from Jerusalem to Tehran is less than 1,000 miles. From Jerusalem to Merv is 1,400 miles. Same distance as Rome. So it is 2,000 miles from Jerusalem to Paris or London. But Samarkand in the middle of Central Asia is only 1,850 miles. So Merv and Rome are just as far from Jerusalem as one another. And places in the East that we tend to think of as far, far away are actually not any further from Jerusalem than places in the West that we tend to think of as close at hand. But the story of the church in the East is a gigantic story that is not well remembered today. But from the 5th century up through the 12th century, a very large part of the growth of the church happens on this map. And happens across the eastern part of the church. And much of the strength of the church is in these places. And the monasteries of the East are the power that drives the expansion of the church here, because they provide places where education happens, where the scriptures are copied, where things are preserved. They are key centers from which missionaries go forth and are the fundamental elements of the expansion of the church across Central Asia and the conversion of many hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people. So that's some things about the church to the south and the east. As we move into the second 500 years of the existence of the church. And as the church in the West, particularly the church that is influenced from Rome, falls into some difficult times, in some difficult centuries, the growth of the church in the East at the same time is very large, such that there are probably more Christians east of Constantinople than there are west until at least the 1200s and maybe even later than that. So anyway, a few things to think about as we think about you know, missions and where are we going. There are many places that we're invested in missions where the church has been before. You know, the church has been in Ethiopia probably for 18 centuries, and we still do missions there because there's still unreached people there. But we need to do those missions respecting the fact that there have been believers there for a very, very long time. And that is true in many other places across the East. This is Philip Jenkins' book, The Lost History of Christianity. This is fascinating, and if you've not had a chance to get into this, I would strongly recommend it. This is a history, it's a very good history of the church in the East, and of what happened to it, and we'll come back to that hopefully here in a few weeks. You know, the history of the church in the East is a great untold story, and part of the reason that we tend not to tell it is it's also the story about how the church dies. And that's what we're thinking about, too. So we'll come back and poke at that. How the church dies. There were great churches across all of Central Asia, and then there weren't. So, that's a warning to us all. It is easy for us to believe that the church always continues to exist, but it's not true in every place. And so, the book, Lost History of Christianity, Philip Jenkins. The Lost History of Christianity, Philip Jenkins is the author. So, anyway, it's an interesting read and a cautionary one. So we'll come back to that along the way here. Anyway, Lord, we thank you for the day. We thank you for the time. We thank you for your faithful people down through the ages. We pray that we might learn and be wise. Be discerning and remember those that have come before us, the sacrifices that they have made, and the things that you have done, that we might rejoice in how you have grown your church for the sake of your glory. Amen.